Hey, everyone, welcome to Senate Finance. It's 9:02 on the Ides of March. I want to welcome Senator Bundy, Senator Dyson, and Senator Stedman to the table. The purpose of today's meeting is to have a presentation by the Department of Corrections on the cost containment model for research-based presentation on sex offender management. And that is all we're going to do today. And with that, morning, Senator Olson.
Morning, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anything to come before the committee before we begin? Senator Green is en route back to Juneau. We'll be in tonight. Anything else? Seeing none, then let's welcome Commissioner Antrim to the table. Good morning, sir. If you would lead us off and introduce your special guests and what we're going to do today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Antrim. I'm the Commissioner for the Alaska Department of Corrections. I want to thank you and the committee, sir, for giving us the opportunity this morning to introduce the sex offender containment model approach that we're going to take with sex offender supervision in the state of Alaska. To aid us in that effort, we've asked some experts from the State of Colorado program, which is in operation currently. We have three folks with us here this morning from Colorado: Kim English, Peggy Heil, and Jeff Jenks, who will talk to us about the approach of the containment model theory and then introduce the polygraph testing approach to us as well. So with that, if I would like to ask these three to step forward and take over the presentation, and thank you again for your time this morning.
Thank you, Commissioner. Welcome, folks. If you'd come forward, please. Welcome to the Capitol and to Alaska. First trip for all of you, or are you sourdoughs?
We were in Anchorage before, but this is the first time in Juneau.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you were in Anchorage, you really weren't in Alaska.
We realize that. It's beautiful here. Thank you for inviting us. Kim English for the record.
And if you're real bad, they'll send you to Fairbanks because you're suffer.
Come on, folks. Go ahead and introduce yourselves for the record. And we've got two laptops in front of us. Looking forward to hearing your presentation. And
Thank you.
Before we begin, would you prefer us to hold our questions until the end?
We're hoping that we might be able to answer a few of them as we go through this.
Okay.
We were planning on maybe having some question and answer period at the end.
At the end. So if there's something for clarification, please let me know. If there's something for discussion, let's hold those to the end.
Okay. Thank you.
If you would, please, the floor is yours.
Kim English.
Jeff Jenks.
And Peggy Heil.
Thank you very much for inviting us. We are here on behalf of the Alaska Department of Corrections to talk about a method of managing sex offenders that's a growing method. It's used in a number of jurisdictions nationwide. And we applaud the Department of Corrections for considering this to be a dangerous population. The U.S. Department of Justice did a study several years ago and found that 45%, nearly half, of state prisoners participating in a survey that the Bureau of Justice Statistics did, that about half of them, 45%, committed the crime while they were on probation or parole. 24% of prisoners serving time for rape and 19% of prisoners serving time for sexual assault committed that crime while they were under correctional supervision. So you're already talking about 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 known sex offenders committing another crime. Here's what we're hoping to talk to you about this morning. We want to talk to you about the containment approach overall. We'll try to set the stage for the need for specialized sex offender management practices. This is not an offender population that is similar to other offender populations, and we're going to try and talk a little bit about that. Rape victims don't report this crime, and we have to understand how that affects what we understand about sex offenders and what we need to know about how to manage them. One of the goals of the containment approach is to obtain information for the purposes of protecting the public. We can learn a lot from sex offenders, and we have learned a lot. We'll review some of that with you today. Jeff is going to talk about using the polygraph examination. Jeff has conducted 34,000 polygraph exams, and we'll be drawing on his expertise to talk to you about that this morning. Treatment provides information and an opportunity for the offender to change. Peggy developed and managed the treatment program at the Colorado Department of Corrections for over 20 years. And she has considerable experience in using treatment to learn more about sex offenders, as well as helping them change their life patterns. We wanted to talk to you, too, a little bit about housing. This is a big issue nationwide, where sex offenders may live when they leave the Department of Corrections. Quality control for any new method that you implement, and there is a cost benefit of containment. We'll talk to you about that too. So, and then we'll talk about questions. You probably know this, but in 2000, Alaska ranked first in rapes per capita in the United States. In fact, Alaska's reported rape rate is twice the national average. This translates into one forcible rape every 15 hours and 15 minutes, 15 and a quarter hours. Forcible rapes are on the increase. This is reported crimes. Remember that for sex crimes to come to the attention of any of us, the victim has to report that crime. Reported rapes in Alaska actually increased 21.7% from 2000 to 2003. Now that could be because you're reporting more crimes. Victims perhaps feel more safe. Maybe law enforcement is responding differently at the local level. You had 521 reported forcible rapes and 54 reported attempted rapes in 2003. There's research to indicate that maybe 1 in 100 rapes is actually reported. You have approximately 4,300 registered sex offenders in Alaska communities. And they're very spread out, are they not? That's one of your challenges. We want you to take away from this presentation the fact that the cost of sexual assault is incredibly high. More than half of the victims have been raped more than once, either a single episode where there were multiple assaults or multiple assaults of the same victim over time. Victims of sexual assault are 6 times more likely to develop post-traumatic stress syndrome. Many of you know that that is night sweats, headaches, nightmares, incredible anxiety, a very uncomfortable way to live. 3 times more likely to develop major depression. And sexual assault victims are 13 times more likely to attempt suicide. This is the cost to society is incredibly high. 521 victims of a completed rape in Alaska will total lifetime cost to those victims of $45 million. Each year, you are accumulating $45 million in lifetime costs to the victims who were assaulted that year. This is what we really want you to understand, and what we learned through trying to understand sex offenders better. Only 16% of victims in the Rape in America study reported the rapes. These were adult women who were asked about their lifetime sexual assault experience. Of those who had been raped, only 16% of the victims in the Rape in America study reported the rape, and half of those reported it 5 years later. So those crimes, of course, could never be prosecuted. We know from researchers studying victims of sexual assault that those who delay disclosure of the crime are younger and tend to know the perpetrator. So what you're getting here is that child molesters, or I should say actually offenders who choose children, are choosing children who are unlikely to tell. Those who are more likely to report the crime experienced a life threat, and as an aside, most sexual assault victims believe that their life was in danger during the assault. The majority believe that. Where there was physical injury, so there wasn't a question that the victim was compliant and the perpetrator was a stranger. So the people who end up in my studies are much more likely to be stranger perpetrators or someone who chose a victim who was empowered to report. On top of the fact that we have very few reports, let's look at this. 27% of reported sex crimes resulted in an arrest. This was a study of about 16 states. So you can begin to see the funnel here. Hardly any victims report the crime. Very few times do we have enough information to make an arrest. And once they're arrested in Colorado, we did a study that showed between 50 and 70% of those who were charged with a felony sex crime were actually convicted of a felony sex crime. Convicted of a sex crime. Sometimes they do plead down to misdemeanors. We would, by the way, as an aside, always recommend that sex crimes never be pled to a crime outside the family of sex crimes. Otherwise, you lose that information forever from the record that this was a sex offender. So when you look at sex offender recidivism rates, which are very frequently the sound bites that you hear about sex offenders, their recidivism rates are generally quite low. We have to remember, though, that these are often based on conviction data. So for incest offenders, when victims are least likely to report, they have young victims, they know the perpetrator, you see the recidivism rate being quite low, lower compared to the others. Rapists, where you're more likely to have an adult victim, where there might be violence, and there might be a stranger crime, you see the rates going up a bit. Overall, the point to be made here is that whatever official recidivism rate that we're working with, it's going to be artificially low because victims are not empowered to report the crime. Offenders choose victims that don't report the crime. And why don't victims report the crime? In one study, children ages 3 to 12, explained that delaying disclosure by saying they feared being disbelieved, punished, or unprotected. In this study, these were children that were sent to the emergency room for having a sexually transmitted disease. They were interviewed by trained interviewers, and only half of them disclosed that they had been sexually assaulted. The age of victims at the time of the rape is typically a crime of youth. 60 to 65% of victims are below the age of 18. When adult victims are asked about their reporting behaviors, they say that they are concerned about their family knowing. This is why they don't report the crime. They're concerned about their family knowing. Oftentimes it is a family perpetrator. 68% are concerned about others knowing, just the general others knowing. 69% are concerned about being blamed by others. We still have a society that blames the victim. Because of the lack of information, and because the onus of obtaining any information at all has always been on the back of the victim, one of the things that we try to do with the containment approach is to obtain information from the offender and other places. But we try to get information from the offender and share that information for the purpose of protecting the public and the potential victims. The containment approach is in large part grounded in this triangle of the polygraph examiner, the treatment provider, and the criminal justice system. The polygraph is one tool among all of the other tools that you will have here. You have victim services, you will have victim therapists, you will have conditions of supervision, of criminal justice supervision, monitored leisure time, ear analysis testing, other things that we already do in the criminal justice system, in addition to employment restrictions, internet restrictions. And in the containment approach, you have consistent policies that are research-driven and that are intended to help the people in the field who are trying to manage the population on a day-to-day basis. We're going to talk today not so much about the items on the side, the additional tools that you'll use to manage this population. We'll be talking more specifically about the three anchors of the triangle. The criminal justice system provides a behavior. For example, it's important to have consequences for failed polygraph exams. If there's nothing at stake for the offender to pass a polygraph exam, then there's less likelihood that the offender actually will pass the exam. You have to have consequences, just like children. If you say, you don't need to clean your room until Friday afternoon at 3, when does the room get cleaned? And if you don't do anything when the room doesn't get cleaned, what happens? The consequences need to be immediate. They need to be linked to the implied risk. So whatever it is that is of concern when the offender takes the polygraph exam and fails, those are the things to focus on. They need to include immediately increased surveillance. They need to involve obtaining corroborating information, not just what you obtain from the polygraph exam, but additional information that you can obtain from other people in the offender's life. And you have to include others in the information about what you've obtained from the polygraph. This approach, the containment approach, requires an incredible amount of collaboration across disciplines, across the mental health system, across the criminal justice system, and across the polygraph world and law enforcement world. The idea is that you get information and share it. One study that is core to understanding the containment approach is that sex offenders who failed supervision tended to see themselves as no risk to the community. They minimized their risk. They were still in denial. They had diverse victim types. How do you find out about whether or not someone has diverse victim types? Well, Peggy and Jeff will talk to you more about that. These folks tended to fail soon. So after they left prison and were in the community, the ones who failed tend to fail soon because they were out of control. They were also given access to victims. What you'll see with the containment approach is an incredible effort to keep offenders from accessing past and potential victims. That means that sex offenders are considered a danger, no matter what their conviction crime is, say they were convicted of rape, that they're still considered a danger to all vulnerable people, including children. They have attitudes of sexual entitlement, and they have poor social influences. So they have a lack of support. Peggy will talk a little bit more about that later. We have a few studies that we wanted to share with you that help us better understand sex offenders. We're going to learn from what they've told us about who they are. This is the first time Peggy and I collaborated on a research study. And we compared the information that was known at the time of the court hearing from the pre-sentence investigation through what we've got in the first column is the number of victims that the sex offender, or that the number of victims that we knew of. And then in the second column, the number of offenses that we knew of. And at the time of sentencing, there was generally an average of 2 victims and an average of 7 known offenses by this perpetrator. By the time they go into treatment, into Peggy's treatment program at the prison when she ran it, through treatment, we know that people give a lot more information about who they are, because you begin to trust the therapist, and that's what working through this is all about. They have an assignment where they complete a sex history, where they write out their entire sex history so that you begin to understand all of the victims and all of their patterns of accessing the victims. At the time of their completion of the sex history, we knew on average of 83 victims in almost 400 offenses. Now, these are hands-on and hands-off offenses. So this includes voyeurism, for example, but also rape.
What are the numbers in the parentheses specifically?
That's the median, the midpoint. You have a handful here who are very, very busy, and so that throws the average, the 83, it throws it up. And so the median sometimes is considered a more stable number. However, in this study, the majority of people that were passing the polygraph were the really high-rate offenders. Most people were not passing the polygraph yet here. Like 30% were passing. They were the ones who were telling the truth, and their numbers were very high. So there are many stories to be told here in just this one slide. At the point of the first polygraph, we then knew of 165 victims, but you can still see the skewing is great, right? You've got a lot of people who are high. But those folks at the high end are passing the polygraph. So it's not like it's not a valid number. In fact, those low numbers are probably needing to be pushed up higher once they actually pass. Because then you can see that at the point of the second polygraph, we're getting much more information. So as over time and over the use of additional polygraphs, you get more information and more people passing the exam. And what you want to do with this information is use it to inform treatment and inform supervision. In most cases, if you have only what's involved at sentencing, and you're not using the polygraph, and you're not using a comprehensive treatment program that is trying very hard to get at past information, you might be developing a treatment plan and a supervision plan on someone who could have two victims and seven offenses. That looks very different from at the end of the second polygraph exam.
Kim, at what point in time is the polygraph test given?
The first polygraph is usually given in the first 6 months of treatment, first 6 months of intervention.
After conviction?
Oh, absolutely. These are after conviction. In this case, yes, they were in prison already, and in the containment approach, the use of the polygraph is referred to as the post-conviction polygraph.
So is it given while incarcerated or after incarceration?
Well, both. It depends on how you set up your system. Okay. What you're going to be doing here in Alaska, you'll be doing them outside in the community after they leave. This information is obtained in the prison, while they were in treatment in the prison in Peggy's program.
So as a condition of release, the availability and the approval or the
need for the polygraph?
I'm looking for the word, but the person that was in jail has agreed to have a polygraph as a condition of release?
Well, yes, that they'll participate in treatment that includes the use of the polygraph, treatment and supervision.
Okay.
And hopefully the conditions will say that they will cooperate, engage in treatment, and pass the polygraph, that the conditions will be that specific.
Okay, question?
Oh, Sarah Dyson.
So do you give immunity before they take the polygraph for these people that are taking it post-conviction?
Well, there are four different ways of managing that, managing the issue of the new disclosure, the new disclosed information, and Jeff or Peggy, I'm not remembering which one, actually we'll go over that with you in just a minute.
Right.
And we have it in the tiniest of print, that if you actually have a magnifying glass, you might be able to follow along. These are tiny overheads in your handout. This is a very important slide. Between the three of us, we have hundreds of these slides. This is the one we chose to show you. The reason we have hundreds of these slides are because it is so common that what we know at the point of the court sentence is that adult and child victim, is that we don't know very much, basically. For example, we knew on the top line the types of offender, the proportion of offenders in Peggy's treatment program that had assaulted adult and child victims. We knew from the pre-sentence investigation, which went to the judge, that 7% of the 223 offenders had assaulted across age groups. That jumped to 70%. And remember, most of these folks are still not passing the polygraph. Crossing gender, male and female, we knew that almost 10% had a history of both genders in their victimization past. That jumped to one-third. In multiple relationships, this is incest versus position of trust versus acquaintance versus stranger. Most people think that a stranger rapist is a stranger rapist is a stranger rapist. This is not the case. This is a crime of opportunity, and that's what these numbers are beginning to show. Incest perpetrators, in particular, folks tend to think that they only offend inside the family. And once the children get older, that person is no longer at risk. Most victims say that their perpetrator, who was a family member, also harmed their girlfriends. Here's a group of 80 incest perpetrators. This is not Colorado data. This was a study we did where we were able to collect data from other states. These are folks who were just convicted of incest and who just refiled their conviction crime. We would have never known that one-third of them had a history of assaulting strangers. Another 57% assaulted from a position of trust. These incest perpetrators, one-third of them had also assaulted adult victims. The average age of onset is quite young. It varies depending on what the study is, but in all of the studies, the age of onset is typically 15, 16, and down to 12 and 13. This means that there is an enormous lag in the detection time, usually around 10 to 15 years, that sex offenders have been busy doing what they do before they come to the attention of the criminal justice system. And I hope that one of the things that we've shown you so far is that their coming to the criminal justice system is not a function of who they are, but rather the victim that they chose that reported that crime that time. I'm going to turn it over to Jeff now so that he can talk about how the polygraph works.
Once again, my name is Jeff Jenks, owner-operator of Amichan Jenks Incorporated. Began doing polygraph exams in 1978, and to date have conducted a little over 34,000. Majority prior to 1989 were pre-conviction tests, and I examined all types of criminals, homicide, thefts, arson, so on and so forth, and a lot of sex offenders pre-conviction. In Oregon and Washington, those two states, they started doing post-conviction sex offender testing in the early 80s, so we knew that they were conducting these exams. In Colorado, we were the first to conduct a polygraph examination post-conviction on a sex offender in 1989. The first individual that we tested, which was a local therapist that brought one of his clients in, he had a hunch that this individual was not telling the complete story, wanted to have a polygraph examination run on him. I'm not sure if this therapist really cared so much as far as accuracy or reliability, which I'm going to talk about with the polygraph because obviously it's a very important question in regards to the polygraph. But he primarily wanted to see what kind of information he could get kind of out of his office using another individual that was not in the therapeutical setting, utilizing the polygraph, and to see what type of information would come forward. This individual was on an 8-year probationary program for sexually assaulting one of his daughter's friends. His daughter was approximately 10 years of age at the time. He had one victim. He was convicted on that, and as I said, he was given 8 years. When he came into our offices, in the pretest itself, this is before the actual exam, he admitted four other victims to me before I even conducted the polygraph. After the polygraph, he admitted another three victims, including both of his daughters, who had, he had never been suspected of sexually assaulting before. With this information, the therapist then turned around and tested everyone in his program. And if you set aside the accuracy, reliability of the polygraph, and you just go with just the information alone that we get from the use of the polygraph, it just turned his program upside down as far as what he learned after the use of the polygraph. I'm going to talk about, as I said, why the polygraph works. There has to be a fear of detection. Polygraph's not a party tool. I can't take it to a party and start testing people around the room on different acts. If the fear of detection is not there, it's not going to be a reliable and accurate tool. Some of you have probably seen one of those reality shows, the Who Wants to Marry My Dad? And I actually got called to be the examiner on that show. And one of my first questions was, where is the fear of detection on this show? These people are more interested in being in front of the camera and getting their spot, or being in front of the spotlight, than they are telling the truth to various questions about why they wanted to marry these girls' father, and if they liked his cooking, and if they, you know, what their different activities were going to be with them. And I'll get into question formulation and the importance of question formulation, but the fear of detection is simply not there in those shows. That is strictly there for Hollywood. It's not a realistic portrayal of what actually happens during a polygraph. When the fear of detection is there, the fight or flight response takes control, which then affects their autonomic nervous system, which is what we measure. The nervous system they have no control over of. Their blood pressure, their pulse rate, their blood volume, their galvanic skin response, which is an electrical current that flows through the fingertips. We measure it through electrodes on the fingers that measure it through perspiration, and then finally respiration we also measure. In 1989, the computerized polygraph came about. Most of the polygraphs you'll see on TV and in movies is the old standard instrument with the ink pens going up and down measuring. For the most part, that went away. Some examiners in the United States still utilize that, very few, however. Most everyone have gone to the computerized scoring. And the advantage to that is prior to the computerized, it was the examiner himself determining truth or deception. He was scoring up the charts, and he alone was determining whether or not the individual is being truthful. Now we have very complicated mathematical algorithms from Johns Hopkins University that also analyze the data for us. It's called PolyScore. Johns Hopkins touts it at a very high percentage rate of accuracy. They tout it at over 99%. However, that is given just perfect situations, a specific issue polygraph on a specific situation. And in the real world, those type of polygraphs are only about a third of what we do. The utility type polygraph that we utilize, we conduct more than just one relevant area or testing on more than one issue, and I'll get into that in a little bit also. You can go on to the next slide. I'm sorry, thank you. The National Academy of Sciences in 2003 set the median accuracy of the polygraph at 89% with a range of 70 to 99%. Now, the one thing I want to stress on this is, first of all, the 70%, the studies they did on that was given the worst circumstances. First of all, they dealt with a lot of what they call pre-employment type polygraph examinations, which can conduct up to 20 relevant questions that they're trying to test these individuals on. That is going to be an inaccurate test. And by inaccurate, I'm saying those were still at 70% accuracy, but in my line of work, that would be unacceptable. 70 would be way too low, and could not live with that. But there are up to 20 relevant questions. With sex offenders in this population, when we test them, we test a maximum of 3 to 4 relevant questions. The accuracy rate goes up, the reliability rate goes up. The other thing you're looking at with polygraph accuracy is the experience of the examiner themselves. Given those situations, we would like to think the accuracy rate is closer to that 99% than the 70%. In reality, we're probably at around 5% accuracy with this population of individuals. What happens during an exam? When an individual comes in, we sit down with them in a pretest format where we're talking with them, we're going through their medical conditions, because the polygraph is a medical recording device. If they are sick or if they just got out of the hospital, they're under a lot of pain or discomfort, we will not test them at that time. We want to go at their most normal. Now, if at their most normal means they are under medications or they have some discomfort, but that's discomfort, say, the back is probably the most common thing that we see. An individual's had back discomfort for quite some time. If it's something they're used to, that is at their most normal at that time, so we'll go ahead and test them. But it's very important for us to go through their medical conditions. We have them sign release and consent forms. We explain the purpose of the exam. Nobody is ever given a polygraph until they know exactly what questions are going to be on the test. It's not a surprise tactic. We don't sit them down, hook them up, and start asking questions, which is what you will see on the reality TV shows. It's as though these people never knew the questions beforehand. They're just surprising them with them. If you do that, you're going to get a surprise response, and a surprise response looks very close to a deceptive response. So you never want to surprise the person with a question. They're going to know exactly what questions are on the test and in what order before we actually start testing them. So as you can see, the pretest is extremely important. It lasts anywhere from a half hour to sometimes up to an hour and a half, just going through all the different areas with them. We explain the purpose. We review the equipment with them. We tell them, we just don't hook them up. We tell them what these different things measure. We review terminology. With sex offenders, it's very important that we're all on the same page as far as our definitions. What does physical sexual contact mean? Definitions are very important. What does forced sexual contact mean? You asked a question earlier, how soon do we do the first polygraph? And one of the reasons why the first polygraph is not conducted when they first enter these treatment programs is because the treatment provider, it's very important that they also go through these definitions with the individuals, letting them know what these definitions mean legally, what they've done. If you take nothing else away from what I say, you have to know that this particular population rationalizes better than any other criminal in the world. When I started doing post-conviction sex offender polygraphs, I could not believe the rationalization that these individuals use to excuse their behavior. If I were to sit them down and test them on number of victims that they've had, they don't see these people as victims usually. Even if they molest their daughter, they don't see their daughter as a victim. They see their daughter as she shouldn't have dressed as provocatively as she has. The mother shouldn't let her dress the way she... The daughter's been coming on to me for years, therefore it was my duty to teach her about sex. I mean, this is the way their mind revolves around these issues. And so definitions and reviewing terminology is extremely important. We develop the final questions, as I said, so there's no surprise or trick questions. The calibration of the instrument with the computerized polygraph, it's done automatically for us. The end test phase, as I said, 2 to 4 relevant questions. We're not sitting them down and asking them 20 different questions on a single exam. Now, in the pretest interview, we'll go through many areas, sometimes up to 80 and 90 different areas, and then we'll develop the 2 to 4 relevant questions for the test itself. Yes, did you have a question?
No, I'm sorry.
Okay, I'm sorry. All right. With the 2 to 4 relevant questions, they are tucked inside of 2 or 3 comparison questions. Comparison questions, without going into great detail, are more broad-based questions and questions that we are not determining truth or deception on. Relevant questions must be very specific and to the point. They have to be easily recognizable by the subject that we're testing. They have to know what the question means. They have to be able to word it back to us and tell us what it means so that we know we're not asking them those surprise and trick questions. We run a minimum of 3 sets of charts. This is to get consistency of responses. We just don't take the response off one exam and determine truthfulness or deception. It has to be a minimum of 3 sets of charts. And then we finally score and interpret the chart markings. One of the most important aspects of giving a polygraph is the post-test interview. And this is where the experience of the examiner really comes into play. How capable are they of, number one, doing a thorough pretest interview in which they develop the questions and get a lot of information from the individual without any type of interrogative approach? The pretest interview is simply a question and answer period. In fact, if you were to watch a polygraph examination, you, for the most part, would probably be surprised on how non-confrontive it is. I think a lot of people, when they come in for a polygraph or they view watching a polygraph session, they think it is going to be a very confrontational approach for an hour and a half or 2 hours, and it's not at all. In fact, it's kind of boring to watch a polygraph examination take place. Because it is non-confrontational. The post-test interview, however, does get a little more confrontational. By that I mean it's not an argument session at all. It's simply statements on the part of the examiner telling the individual that they are having problems in certain areas. In our opinion, they're not telling the truth in certain areas, and we're developing further information in the post-test interview. Our confession rate for individuals that fail their polygraph examination is just over 90%. So what that means is it's not just relying on the polygraph results themselves when these people are disciplined after the polygraph. It's not just the polygraph results. It's also their statements made back to a very professional interviewer and interrogator. So it's not just their word against ours, someone failing a polygraph and going back and saying, but I told the truth. Well, we have the confession to go along with that over 90% of the time. The purposes of the post-conviction exams vary. There's primarily four different types of tests that we do. The first one normally is the sex history and is administered anywhere from 3 to 6 months into the program after they've written their sex histories. We obtain information on past victims and past methods used to access those victims, the need to know their age of onset, frequency, extent of crossover behavior. You had asked a question previously on how these individuals are treated in the courts as far as how that information is used against them. With most of the sex history polygraphs, we don't go into great details on their past victims as far as exact names of the individuals of the victims. The primary thing we're after at this point is what was the relationship of the victim, what was the age, how they accessed those victims, and we leave it vague enough to where that information usually is not going to be used against them from the polygraph mode. Now, once they go back into therapy, then if the therapist wants to get that information from them and use that, they have that option. But in the state of Colorado, and they can speak to this better than I can, it's been a very successful program in that these individuals know that when they're in here for these sex histories, they're in there primarily for the therapeutical purpose of disclosing all of their victims. And they have to do this for treatment to work with them and for them. So that is the purpose, the primary purpose of the sex history. The specific issue, many times when the offender comes in, they're obviously in denial about their crime. Many of these individuals, even though they've been convicted, a lot of them have pled. A lot of them have taken, we don't see a whole lot of Alford pleas anymore or even deferred prosecutions, but many of them have pled without admitting to their crime itself. When they come in for the polygraph, if they are under denial, that will be the first test that we do. We have to get them out of denial for treatment to work. And the polygraph is extremely successful in doing that. I would guess easily 90% of these individuals that are on denial, when they leave the polygraph lab, are no longer under denial. They are admitting at least most of their crime. Maybe not all of it. That will come later with the therapist's work and the PO's work, but they are admitting a major part of their crime at that time. They may have failed a recent polygraph examination, or there may be a recent allegation against them. That would be another reason for the specific issue polygraph examination. This is going to be by far the most accurate test that we give. We're dealing a very specific point in time, a very specific allegation against them. Accuracy rating is easily going to be in the mid to high 90 percentile range. The maintenance tests, where we're checking out assault patterns and behaviors regarding supervision conditions. We're looking for precursor behaviors. These are usually conducted every 3 to 6 months, and we're testing them such as, while on probation, have you had physical sexual contact with anyone under the age of 18? Have you physically forced anyone to have sexual contact with you? We may get more specific into child pornography. Depending on the individual's MO and what their crime was, we may deal with other aspects such as voyeurism or exposing, just depending on the individual's assaultive behavior. The sex history exam, we deal with types of past victims, as I said, gender, age, relationship, frequency of assaults, types of behavior, voyeurism, rape, child molesting, use of internet. Many of these individuals have been caught on internet stings. where they have arranged to meet with someone that they've met through the internet that's, say, 14 years of age or 13 years of age. They arrange to meet with them. They, in fact, have been talking to a police officer while online, and the police officer meets them there to escort them directly to jail. Many of the individuals that we're testing have been caught in just those type of sting operations. Therefore, questions surrounding that become very important for them. Their modus operandi, did they get friendly with the parent? We put a pet down in the corner there for a reason. Many of these individuals use pets as how to groom their victims. They're walking along a path with a dog. What are they going to attract? They're going to attract children, and children are going to want to come up and pet their animals, and they are automatically into the grooming process at that time. So we're going to talk about that, and we're going to talk about, did they use a pet? Or did they use the internet? Or did they use candy? Or did they use their children, their own children, to get close to the victims? Did they go to church to find single, exhausted moms? Always engaged in obscene phone calls before rape. That's something that a lot of these guys do. We talk about the crossover behavior at the very end, lured with a puppy. I'm a very suspicious parent, obviously, because of what I do for a living. My kids have been involved in athletics. And I'm always suspicious of a coach that is coaching that has no children. I shouldn't be that way because many of these individuals, in fact, a vast majority of them, are just fine. They're doing it because of the sheer enjoyment of teaching kids. But there is a vast majority or a vast percentage of them that are there for the wrong reasons. Sunday school teachers, Boy Scout leaders, if they don't have children, a vested child in that program, my antennas go up. Because I've seen, and even if they do have a child in the program, my antennas are still up in those situations because, unfortunately, they prey on children and they take those positions so they can be around children. The specific issue exam used when the offender is denying offense or significant aspects of the offense. A lot of times we'll have the individuals who they admit the offense itself, but they do not want to talk about the force factor of it. Their victim says, he tied her up. They will admit, yes, I had sexual contact with this 12-year-old girl. Yes, I touched my penis to her vagina. Yes, I fondled her, but she wanted me to do it. There was no force involved. I would never tie anyone up. That is a very common statement that we hear. It's easier for them to admit the sexual assault than it is the forcible part of it. And that's a lot of what our specific issues tests go into, is the force that was used against these victims. The specific issue exam also used, as I said, when there's an allegation and used to clear up a past deceptive test. If they come in, they take a polygraph, they fail a particular area, but there are no new admissions or there are very few admissions. Many times these individuals throw us bones. They tell us minor things that they've done in hopes that we'll just take it and run away with it and not bother them anymore. We know that this happens a vast percentage of times. So these people will go back to therapy. The therapist and the PO will work with them for a few weeks, usually disclosing or usually getting more information out of them through disclosure. Then they come back for another polygraph to verify those statements and whether or not that was what caused their original deceptive finding. The monitoring polygraph to monitor problem behavior. Now, monitoring usually means we're monitoring criminal behavior that could affect their probation. And that would be the child pornography, the sexual assault against a minor, the forcible sexual act. We talked about maintenance polygraph earlier. That would be more therapeutical issues, but it can also include some monitoring issues. Therapeutical issues, one of the important aspects is finding whether or not these individuals are still masturbating to devious thoughts of their past victims. If they are doing that, they are not getting what they need to be getting out of treatment. They're still fantasizing. They're still objectifying teenage girls or even younger out on the street. They're still masturbating to these thoughts and images on a regular basis. That can be a very precursor to their behavior and be part of their cycle that they're in. And they want them to stop that. So that may be one of the things that we cover on a maintenance polygraph. With the monitoring test, that's okay. The monitoring test provides information on whether the offender is changing his lifestyle and applying what they are learning in treatment. It provides information on whether he is continuing to engage in high-risk behaviors. The other thing we've talked about, and the other thing I would really like you to take away from this, is the crossover behavior with these individuals. When I first started doing post-conviction testing, most of my testing with sex offenders had been pre-conviction, only on the offense itself. I had no clue what we were ready to get into when we started doing post-conviction testing. And that is, as Kim was stating earlier, the rapist is not just the rapist. The voyeur is not just the voyeur. These guys are very busy. They are sexually motivated towards a lot of different things, and they are committing a lot of different sex crimes. The child molester is not just the child molester. He's out doing other types of things also. Probably the most surprising one to me was the rapist, who's not just the rapist. They many times also prey on children. I just had a preconceived notion in my business that the rapist was, that was primarily his crime. He was just going to go after adult women. It was a take charge process for them, and they were going to just primarily prey on adult women, and I have found just the opposite to be true. They prey on everyone and anything at any time if given the opportunity. Well, specific issue tests are used to clarify risk concerns. A specific issue exam should be scheduled when concern persists even after increased surveillance. And one thing you will find once you start this program is just because someone is passing their polygraph, that's not a time to take a deep breath and sigh and go, finally, we have this guy under control, because that is not the case many times. Once they pass a polygraph, a lot of times these offenders think that gives them free rein to go out and start doing what they were doing before, because everyone trusts them all of a sudden. They were able to come in and tell the truth on a single polygraph, and nothing could be further from the truth. They almost have to be watched a little closer than the ones that are failing. At least with the ones that are failing, we know they're not telling the truth. With the ones that are passing, we have to watch them even closer sometimes. Polygraph is a deterrent. Abrams and Ogard in 86 studied the deterrent effects of polygraph on offenders on probation. Supervision with polygraph, 69% successful compliance with probation. Without polygraph, 26% successful compliance with probation. The polygraph ends up being a 24-hour leash for these individuals. Even though they're not polygraphed every week, maybe 6 months may go by, it's always in their mind that they are going to be taking that polygraph. And what they tell us in exit interviews time and time again is, I was so tempted to do such and such, but I knew I had my polygraph coming up and I didn't want to have to answer for that, nor did I want to have to go through having to fail a polygraph, come back and take another polygraph, the expense that was involved for them. So it becomes a 24-hour leash. They're able to curb their activities somewhat because they know the polygraph is facing them down the road. Examiner qualifications is very, very important. As I said earlier, with that one study that showed 70%, that was with examiners who had just started the process. These examiners had less than 6 months' experience. They were asking many, many different type of relevant questions. With a polygraph, there is certainly the scientific approach, but there is also the artistic approach, and that's where the polygraph examiner's credentials mean a lot, and how many tests they've administered. They have to graduate from an APA accredited school. Colorado standards, we have to have a minimum of 150 criminal issue exams before they can start doing post-conviction sex offender tests. Post-conviction sex offender tests are very tricky polygraphs when a polygraph examiner is first starting, much more so than other criminals. And the reason for that is, gets back to the rationalization that these individuals use for their crimes. You have to understand that as a polygraph examiner in your question formulation. Minimum of 50 clinical examinations in a 12-month period. This is not a profession that a person can do part-time and just come back and start doing sex offenders again. 50 is very low in my opinion. When I argued for much more than this in a 12-month period, and I ultimately lost that argument. I think minimum they should be doing at least 4 to 5 tests per week to remain qualified to do this type of work. When I go on vacation, if I come back 10 days later or 7 days later and I do my first polygraph, it's almost like I'm starting over again with the interviewing and interrogation techniques again. It doesn't take me long to get back into it, but it's something that has to be done on a regular basis to be very effective at it. 40 hours of specialized training every 3 years. This is specialized training in the use of the polygraph and post-conviction polygraphs in particular. Implementation considerations. You have to develop the procedures and educate the therapist on the use of the polygraph. Develop sex history questionnaires, which obviously in Colorado we have made leaps and bounds towards getting a very thorough and good sex history questionnaire, which I'm sure we would be glad to share with the state of Alaska. I mean, it is something that's being used statewide with a lot of programs, and it really helps the process. When they have to bring that in for their polygraph, I know exactly where to go to get the information that I need, and it's consistent from one program to the other. Not all programs, not 100% of the programs use the same form, but they all use a sex history questionnaire, and they are all very similar in the way they're structured. Set examiner qualifications and requirements. They've already done an incredible amount of work here in the state of Alaska in setting those requirements for a polygraph examiner. Probably one of the most thorough that I've seen in any state as far as trying to get the right type of examiners up here to do this work. Videotaping exams is a must. It took us about 1 week to realize we had to videotape each and every one of these guys. Why? They would tell us one thing, they would walk right out of our office into the other room and tell the therapist something completely different than what they just told us in the polygraph. That goes along with this population of criminals. They've been secretive and manipulative their entire lives, and it didn't stop just because they told an examiner one thing. They would leave the room and tell someone else something completely different or deny that they ever said that. We did about 10 tests before we realized we've got to videotape each and every one of these. That put a stop to that immediately. Develop system to track and use results, educate the stakeholders, and develop consequences for the testing and for their deceptive responses.
I'm going to throw it over to Peggy Heil now to talk to you about how to integrate the polygraph with treatment.
For the record, my name is Peggy Heil, and I'm going to talk about the role of treatment in the containment model. Well, that really was just a slide, but...
Well, I can do the summary real quick. Value of polygraph testing and risk assessment, increase information on past offenses. That's the number one and the first value that everyone saw in the use of the polygraph, just the information that we retrieved from the polygraphs. Evaluate treatment, effectiveness, and compliance. And this is a difficult thing for some therapists to get their mind around. You know, none of us like being told that we're not getting the full information from a person. None of us like to be told we're not doing our job to the most effective way we can. And in a sense, polygraph was doing that. We were going back to the therapist and say, this is what you've missed. This is what they're telling us now that they haven't been telling you. And so they had to get their mind around that. And once they were able to do that and work with us as a team and realize we were not against them, we were with them on the same team, that's when this program just kicked into high gear in the state of Colorado. And obviously evaluate the risk of child contact, which individuals will have that contact and which will not.
I'll just say that I have done treatment with sex offenders for approximately 10 years without the benefit of polygraph testing, and then 10 years with polygraph testing. I would never want to do treatment with a sex offender without the benefit of the polygraph information. You really are pretty blind to what's going on without that additional testing information. But polygraph testing is not something that you use in isolation. It does not give you complete information. You can only ask three questions. They may not give you additional information about why they're deceptive. So somebody has to go out and be monitoring their behavior, looking at what they're saying in treatment. It is a collection of information from a variety of sources of information, including collateral information from family members, employers, etc. When we use the polygraph, we find that polygraph plus treatment produces more information about the offender than polygraph alone or treatment alone. You had asked a question about what do? You grant them immunity for the information that they disclose? And what we did in Colorado was we created this chart, which is on the wall, to talk about the different options for the information that would be disclosed during polygraph question. And we brought that to the District Attorney's Council and discussed all these options. And what we ended up going with was we did not ask for the actual names, dates, and locations of the offenses. We asked more information about the patterns. So what was the gender of the victim, the age of the victim, and the relationship category that the victim fell into, so that we can create a profile of what the problems are. There are other jurisdictions that have worked with district attorneys to grant limited immunity. So if they continue to participate in treatment, comply with supervision, then they will not be prosecuted for the crimes. They collect the names, location, dates. But if they fall out of compliance with treatment and supervision, then they would use the information to prosecute on those disclosed crimes. There are pros and cons of each method. If you know the names, you can give the victims treatment, but it does raise some legal difficulties with trying to get agreements with DAs statewide. So those are decisions that should be made, though, before you implement the use of the polygraph. I want to talk about how sex offender treatment is very different than traditional mental health treatment. I think people think sex offenders can't be cured. Why are you wasting resources treating them? And there are several benefits to treating sex offenders. One is that you are actually teaching them skills how to manage their risk and not reoffend. But at any point, they can choose to reoffend anyway. They enjoy the behavior, and especially when they're stressed out, they may make that choice again. It's very similar to somebody who might have a drinking problem. But what you want to do in your treatment is work with the criminal justice system to create a culture that makes the choice to manage their problem more desirable than going ahead and reoffending. And polygraph is part of that incentive, because they know there's a greater chance that they'll get caught if they reoffend. You want to create consequences for making choices not to manage their behavior. The other parts that we don't traditionally think about treatment is that treatment uncovers a lot of information about why they do what they do, the patterns that go into place before they actually reoffend, so that you can intervene before they get to that point where there's a new victim. That information can go to supervising officers so that they can build better plans. They can decide whether that person should live in a household where there's a child. And it also increases the chances with that information that if somebody reoffends, they will be caught sooner rather than later. So one of the things that we did in Colorado is if we shared information about their crime dynamics with law enforcement, and if there were unsolved crimes, law enforcement was sharing those crimes with the people that were working with sex offenders, treatment providers, and supervising officers, and we were looking to who might fit those dynamics as a potential suspect. And so if, remember the numbers of victims that these people have, if they kind of cross that line and reoffend, you want to be able to find them very quickly and contain them. And then the last component that happens in treatment is that we learn about how this develops in people. We learn how people groom victims or set up their offenses. And that information can be shared with law enforcement. That can be shared with victim treatment providers. I think you have an example that was handed out to you about a sex offender documenting how he sets children up for... Oh, you don't have it yet. Okay, you will be getting that. But in our program, that was part of what they had to do. They had to do community service. So you'll see this whole back part of this book is offenders describing how they set up victimization. And we would share that with law enforcement. As an example of how the information grows when you combine treatment with polygraph examination, you'll see in this example, the inmates in this study were in an advanced part of treatment. So they had about 9 months of treatment that met four times a week, so it was very intense, at the point that they took their polygraph test. The parolees in this, the comparison group, had not had treatment in prison. They had just gotten out into the community and really hadn't started treatment at the point that they were tested on the polygraph. The deception rate was very similar, but what you can see is that the inmates, after they were deceptive, gave up information about what that deception was about, where the parolees who were not in treatment really did not give up any additional information. So it's really the combination of working the two back and forth that ends up with the most information. I also want to talk to you a little bit about how treatment with sex offenders differs from traditional treatment. This is really an accountability-based treatment approach. And that is very different than traditional mental health treatment. In traditional treatment, the therapist just accepts what the client has to say. They work to build a trusting relationship. They're non-judgmental of the choices that the client makes. There's no consequences for the choices that they make in their life. And they work on developing insight into their past behaviors on the belief that insight will result in behavior change. They also have complete confidentiality. And when we're working with offenders, those traditional treatment methods switch. We're working on a non-trust basis. We are checking up to find out if what they're telling us in treatment is accurate. We don't accept what they say as non-judgmental about behaviors that hurt people. It's very valued around not victimizing people, not hurting people, not making choices that lead them that direction. We do place responsibility on the client to change, but we also create consequences that if they make choices not to change, we're going to push them in that direction. So if they buy pornography, there should be a consequence for that, because we know that with sex offenders, pornography creates that interest and moves them closer to reoffending. We focus on the present, not the past. Are they actually changing their behavior? And we look for verification of that behavior change. And we limit the confidentiality. We want the supervising officer to have the information that we have because we're working as a team. We want the polygraph examiner also to know the information that we're getting from the client. The focus shifts from just being a therapist for the client to the client is the community, and we're working together with the criminal justice system to promote safety. This is some research on whether this different type of treatment works with sex offenders. And this was a study that was done in the Washington State Institute for Public Policy. They are a group that just looks at what is a wise use of tax dollars. And what you'll see is they looked at research of different types of treatment. Psychotherapy is basically your more traditional mental health therapy, and what you will see is without any treatment, people on supervision had a recidivism rate of 6.4%. When you added psychotherapy, you increased the recidivism rate. So actually, traditional treatment made them worse. But when we use cognitive behavioral treatment, which is what sex offense-specific treatment is, you see you cut the recidivism rate in half. It's also very important that this, you can imagine, 16 years that they've had this problem, you looked at the numbers of victims and offenses so that they've been engaging in this behavior quite frequently over that time period. So you have to have an intense form of treatment, and you have to have a lengthy period of treatment to get people under control and to a place where they can manage the behavior. And that's where it's very important to have this containment to keep them locked into that practicing, the managing of the behavior. Kim English did a research study of the sex offender treatment program at the Colorado Department of Corrections. And there were two phases of treatment in the prison. And once the person paroled, or there was follow-up specialized supervision, there was a containment model, polygraph testing, and treatment in the community. And in the prison, there was treatment and polygraph testing. And what you'll see is that of the people who had no treatment in the prison, only 52% successfully completed parole. Those who had the first phase of treatment, 70% successfully completed parole. And when those who had had the second phase of treatment and the first phase, 84% successfully completed parole. This is a cost saving because those people who failed and were revoked go to a more expensive location, which is prison. They further looked at people who discharged their sentence and just walked out of prison without any supervision. And they compared them with people who discharged their parole. So both groups are no longer under any supervision. But the group in green actually did receive parole supervision as they were transitioning out. And you see again that those who had parole supervision did better as far as violent arrests. So this is the type of arrest we care about, whether people are going back out and committing violent crimes. Those who are under parole had fewer crimes. Those who just walked away, did not have this containment model, had a much higher rate of violent crime. And those who participated in treatment and had the containment model as they transitioned out had the best outcome, had the fewest violent crimes. This is a different treatment program. This is in Twin Rivers Correctional Center in Washington State. And what you'll see again is that both of these groups, the people did participate in treatment in the prison, but part of them had follow-up supervision in the community. And the other group just walked out and did not have this containment model supervision. And you'll see that those who transitioned out with services in the community and supervision had a much lower failure rate than those people who just walked out and were on their own. We also think it's really important to look at where sex offenders live once they are released from prison. And this was a study that was done in Colorado. There was a lot of debate about something that some treatment providers had started, which was called shared living arrangements. They put offenders together in a house and that were under supervision and in sex offender treatment and were receiving polygraph testing. People were very uncomfortable that sex offenders were living in the same location, and so this study was conducted to look at if that was a better situation or a more dangerous situation. And what they found is that people who went back and lived with their families actually had higher revocation rate and higher problematic behavior and reoffenses than those people who were put in a situation where there was more intensive monitoring and there were people where they were living who understood what their risk factors were and were willing to report any problematic behavior that they saw. And I think sometimes we think families might provide that role, but on the other hand, if we think about our own family members, it's hard for us to accept the extent of the problems that our own family members have, and sometimes families actually enable people and look the other way as they see problems because of how painful it is. And so it's very important to be working with family members, if that's where they're going, to accept the extent of the offender's problems, be willing to report problematic behavior, and enforce the whole containment model, which again is the specialized supervision, the treatment, and the polygraph testing. And adding the support system where they live as another part of that containment model is very important. I don't think we'll go into this. I pretty much explained that, but you can look through that, what positive support ended up being. And those are the people who had positive support when they released were the ones who had the fewest violations and the fewest reoffenses.
What were the settings for the success of that aspect, or what were the components that made it so much more successful than living with enablers?
What they looked at, they made a judgment whether they were in a family situation or whether they were in these shared living arrangements. What happened in the shared living arrangements was all the other people in the house were in treatment. They were being polygraph tested. They knew that they would be in trouble on their supervision if they knew something was happening and they didn't report it in. So they, in effect, became a positive support system because they were held responsible if somebody in the house was engaging in high-risk behavior. So they would report what was happening in that house. Now, you don't have to have them in a shared living arrangement, but those are the elements they were able to separate out: the fact that people were holding them accountable, looking at what they were doing, questioning them about, why are you bringing home a child's video? Why are you bringing home Snow White? Or if you know that they get a pet to try and attract children, why did you just bring a puppy home? And then being willing to report that to the supervising officer.
There are a couple more slides.
You want to talk about this?
Yeah.
We just wanted to wrap up with a mention of quality control. We do think that the containment approach saves money in the long run, but it can only be implemented with lots of training for everyone involved. Therapists need to be trained by polygraph examiners, who need to be trained by therapists, who need to be trained by supervising officers. So everybody understands everybody else's job, and everybody's working really closely together. And the more that you can bring local law enforcement to the table, the better. Law enforcement really understands the need to hold these folks accountable. They don't always understand the value of a treatment in that context, but they come to be very, very strong supporters of treatment when it's implemented the way that Peggy has described. You need to have written protocols, adequate supervision, standards of practice, how many hours of training someone like Jeff needs to have before he can be approved by the Department of Corrections to conduct these exams, regular team meetings. People need to talk, collaborate, and meet. Individual treatment plans. Even though we talk a lot about it sounding like a cookie-cutter approach, here's what we're talking about. Using the polygraph of treatment with supervision. The information that you're obtaining through that containment allows you to do a very individualized management plan. And it is the individualized management plan that catches folks before they commit a new sex crime. That's the whole idea. We want to learn about their patterns of offenses and catch them before. And then you want to have measures of progress and program evaluation so you know if what you're doing is working as intended. The Washington State Institute for Public Policy, which you probably know that organization, they have a fabulous website. They work directly for the legislature there, and they do cost-benefit analysis and all other kinds of analyses, too, on a number of different topics. And they have estimated, these are top-notch researchers. These folks have estimated that for every dollar you invest in treatment, you get at least a dollar and 19 cents in return. But if you include that mammoth victimization cost at least $86,000 per victimization, then the return to every dollar can go up to more than $5. We knew that as the Finance Committee that you would be particularly interested in that little piece. We'll take your questions now. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, pardon me. Thank you, Peggy, Kim, Jeff, for a very well-done presentation. How did we do these things before we had PowerPoint, huh? questions from the committee? Comments? None? Commissioner Antrim, would you mind joining us for a moment? Senator Dyson?
Hi. On page 3, it said that costs $86,500 per victim. That's cost to the victim.
Lifetime cost that's been estimated.
Mm-hmm. Not the cost to the state or the taxpayers.
Most of those costs are borne by the public eventually. It's lost work time. It is the hospitalization and medical costs. It's the costs of the criminal justice response.
Ah, okay. I would not have deduced that from this, because it says cost to the victim.
Yeah, it shouldn't. Thank you. We'll change that slide. PowerPoint has its disadvantages, too. When you make a mistake, it's there forever.
Okay. So the cost to the victim is whatever it costs them for mental health, loss of work, failed relationships, and so on. So what is the cost to the public in direct costs, you know, for criminal justice, incarceration, treatment of perpetrator, and costs to provide services to the victim?
What are those costs, did you say?
I assume it's quite a bit more than this $86,000.
I would have to look, do you remember, Peggy? I would have to look at the study to see exactly what they were including, but you're thinking it costs more than $86,000 to prevent the crime?
Negative. To the cost of the crime happening.
Is significantly more than, absolutely. I see what you're saying. Yes, because they're going to do a lot more time in prison, and that's at least $25,000 a year usually, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you. That's for clarifying that.
Okay.
And I might add that those are pretty dated figures at this point, but it's the only study that has been done on that. So I'm sure costs have increased.
Senator Dyson?
I assume that the number of female perpetrators is, that you've dealt with is less than 5%?
Yeah, the figures show that I would say less than 10% for sure. But the reporting rates on, you know, for victim, those who have been victimized by women are even lower than those who have been victimized by men. Much, much lower. And so it's very difficult for them to come to the attention of authorities.
And if I may,
go ahead.
In our state, as I remember, being surprised that the number of male victims, mostly children, was higher than I expected, and maybe a third or something. Is that coincidental with your experience?
It is, indeed.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we look at some of the results that you had up there, what I'd like to do is at least in our state, we've got a disproportionate number of Alaska Natives that are being incarcerated. You look at the things like conviction, the polygraph testing, and the treatment results as well as successes of treatment. How is that a part of your, or do you have numbers for that breakdown for your effectivity?
Are you talking about cultural differences?
Yes.
We don't have numbers breaking down cultural differences, but we have no reason to suspect that, the cultural differences change. The containment is culture neutral, so to speak.
Senator Dyson?
In Alaska, as I remember, a very disproportionate number of the violent crimes and sexual crimes, there was alcohol involved. Is that reflected in your research in other jurisdictions?
The way I usually respond to that is lots of times there's alcohol and drug involvement. Many times offenders try to get victims intoxicated. But the last time my tide went on, I didn't rape somebody. And so the way it's usually managed is that that may be a concern, but that was the method of acting out, that you chose that behavior, sexually assaultive behavior, to act out while intoxicated. That makes that a sex crime, and the substance abuse is secondary. Doesn't mean it doesn't get treated. It's just not an excuse.
One thing I'd like to add to that with this population, sorry Peggy, anecdotally, from a polygraph standpoint, I would say child molesters, for the most part, alcohol is not a factor. However, with rapists, many times alcohol and drugs does become
And I would just add, in working with offenders over the years, many of them had the intent to go out and commit a sexual assault, and they took drugs to boost their courage to go ahead and act out. Alcohol many times can be a component of setting up victims. Many people go to bars and try and find people who will drink so that they can get them in a more vulnerable situation, and that's the person who they're going to target to victimize. So I think alcohol gets involved in many ways, even providing alcohol to children, but it's a unique issue in and of itself, the sex offending that needs to be addressed. And if they are abusing substances, that's a risk factor in their pattern, and you also need to address that.
Senator Olson, did I cut you off? Did you have another question?
No, that was the last question, Mr.
Chairman. Other questions or comments? Senator Dyson?
Page 4, bottom of the page, my page 4 here, recidivism rates. It seems that the last two there, or the next to the last two, child molesters with a male target population have more victims?
There's some research to suggest that, yes.
Yeah. And more recidivism.
Well, they seem to get caught more. It's convoluted sometimes. It's hard to know. But child molesters with male victims often are perpetrating outside the family. And so they really, in fact, I think that Peggy passed around an example of a child molester who set up that child so very perfectly. I think, this is just my opinion, if I look at the recidivism data, by the way it's broken out, typically child molesters and rapists, sort of as if they don't cross over, and you go back to what we're knowing now about how busy they are, the recidivism rates make more sense in terms of their own patterns of behavior and who they choose. It makes them more likely to get caught.
Go ahead.
I guess my final question, which is the punchline, is why are we having this conversation?
Why are we here?
And I assume that there's a plan here, part of the department, to incorporate something of what you all are doing here.
Through the chair to Senator Dyson, that's exactly the case. We hope to have a full-blown pilot project underway this summer in Anchorage that will implement this total model. Already, we've got a large piece of this underway in conducting the assessments of all of our sex offenders. So this will be the final bringing together of all these pieces, tying the treatment that we're doing in the community with the polygraph testing and then the supervising by our probation officers on a more intense level. So that's why we're here today, to introduce this whole, well, again, through the chair to Senator Dyson, we have a $500,000 increment in our budget this year to get this program underway.
And are you proposing to use these folks?
Through the chair to Senator Dyson, we're proposing to use these folks as our guides in getting this underway. That's correct. Mm-hmm. We will have our own in-state personnel doing this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions, comments? Commissioner, anything else as far as takeaways? So we should look for, in the 06 budget, an increment having to do with this topic.
That's correct. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank all the committee members again. I know this is a large block of time you've given us this morning. I really appreciate that. You know, I know that the protecting children is one of this administration's biggest efforts that we have underway. And I, you know, for our department's sake, this is the single most important thing we can do that. The containment approach, in my mind, just to summate it, is really to prevent more victims from being created. And I think that's really what we're about here. So again, I thank you for this. You know, as you're discussing other things that involve our department, I think, you know, this approach has got some pretty wide-ranging implications for things as broad-ranging as visiting, participation by the community, because these folks, anytime they get contact with somebody, you know, they're a potential victim. And so it has a lot of implications, not only for treating them, but also how we operate as a department. So, again, on that note, I thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, and appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Commissioner. And thank you, Kim and Mark. Thank you for cramming a lot of information into an hour and a half and bringing the subject to us. And thanks for traveling all the way here to visit with us. Sounds like we'll see more of you. So anything else come for the committee?
Thank you.
You're welcome. If not, we're adjourned.